For Thursday, the 3rd of August, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. As the UN Security Council appears to move forward on a plan for peace, we'll hear the latest from Beirut. Tens of thousands of Darfur residents protest against a peace deal between the Sudanese government and rebels. And Donald Rumsfeld testifies before a Senate committee today on Iraq. Those stories and more after the headlines.
This is Free Speech Radio News from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. I'm Mitch Jezerich. The Israeli military has begun a new ground and air operation in southern Gaza. It says it's there to make arrests and to search for tunnels it claims is being used to transport arms. Manar Jabrin reports.
In the latest of its month-long military operation, the Israeli army has moved the furthest into the region since the attacks began in late June. At least 50 tanks and bulldozers under fighting jet air cover invaded the Al-Shouka area east of Rafah city today, killing 8 civilians, including a 10-year-old child, and injuring 20 others. At least 160 people were killed in the Gaza Strip since late in June after three resistance factions claimed responsibility for the capture of an Israeli soldier. International humanitarian aid organizations warned of a human crisis in the Gaza Strip because of shortage of food and water and the cutoff of electricity since the beginning of the military operation and the closure of the Rafah crossing. A long line of food containers are waiting at the crossings to be allowed to go through. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
A bomb explosion near a Baghdad shopping center today killed at least 10 people and injured 29. The attack comes as Britain's outgoing ambassador in Baghdad, William Patey, has warned Tony Blair in a confidential memo that civil war is a more likely outcome in Iraq than democracy. And he also predicted the breakup of Iraq along ethnic lines. He did say that the situation is not hopeless, but he said it would remain messy and difficult for the next 5 to 10 years. At least 21 people were killed in a car bomb attack in the southern Kandahar region of Afghanistan. Four NATO soldiers were also killed near the area that is considered to be a stronghold for Taliban fighters. In Sri Lanka, artillery fire hit three schools, killing 18 people in the town of Mattur, as fighting between government troops and Tamil Tigers rages on. Hundreds have been reportedly killed. Panaya Manaka Vasagam has more.
Government spokesperson Minister Kehaliya Rambukwela said the Mattur area is under the government's control. The rebels claimed to have overrun four government-held positions and taken control of a jetty in Mattur that provides access to the strategic harbor at Trincomalee. The military rejected the claim and said dozens of rebels were killed during the flush-out operation. The latest fighting erupted last week as the Sri Lankan military sought to gain control of an irrigation waterway in rebel-held territory. The government accuses the rebels blocking the flow of irrigation water at Mangavilaru to thousands of farmers in the area. Tamil Tigers say that they had to launch this operation to defend civilians and to neutralize the military positions from where the troops were firing mortar and artillery towards the rebel-held areas around Mangavilaru. The military says troops came under artillery fire from the rebels since Monday and Air Force jets bombed the rebel-held areas. Civil sources said more than 20 civilians were killed and over 70 were injured today during the exchange of mortar and artillery fire. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam from Bavuniya, Sri Lanka.
A scientific study released in Delhi found high rates of pesticides in Coke and Pepsi sold in India. Vinod K. Jose reports.
3 years ago, a storm broke out in India when a Delhi-based NGO, Center for Science and Environment, released a study finding pesticides in all the major soft drink brands sold in India, including Coke and Pepsi. Now a fresh study by the same NGO claim that it has found pesticides again in 11 brands, this time much higher than what they found earlier. The study was conducted on 57 samples from 25 manufacturing plants of Coke and Pepsi. It revealed a cocktail of 3 to 6 different pesticides in all the samples. The study revealed, on an average, the amount of pesticide found was 24 times higher than what is approved by the Bureau of Indian Standards. Lindane, a confirmed carcinogen, chloropyrifos, a non-neurotoxin, heptachlor, etc. were found in the samples. From New Delhi, this is Vinod K. Jose.
The heat wave that has killed over 100 people in California last week is now rolling through the Midwest and the East Coast, where another dozen people have died due to the heat and where electrical grids are struggling to remain on. Rebecca Miles has more from New York.
After a 10-day power outage hit Queens last week, about 23,000 households in the area lost power again with the onset of a second major heat wave. New York's power company Con Edison announced a record for peak electricity demand at 13,141 megawatts, topping the 13,103 megawatts used on Tuesday. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has declared a heat emergency for the city, and teams are patrolling the streets looking for homeless people and encouraging them to head to air-conditioned drop-in centres. City officials reported a 20% increase in calls to the emergency medical service on Tuesday, a 10% jump in police 911 calls, and a 50% increase in fire calls. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
And I'm Mitch Jezerich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld testified before a Senate committee today. He admitted to an extremely high amount of sectarian violence in Iraq, but maintained that U.S. troops must stay there to quell the spread of terrorism. Meanwhile, military family members spent another day in Washington attempting to persuade lawmakers to put a stop to the war. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Critical lawmakers showed little optimism about the war in Iraq as Iraqi and U.S. deaths continue to mount. And top war officials didn't deny the alarming amount of sectarian violence. General John Abizaid, head of Central Command, answers questions by members of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
I believe that the sectarian violence is probably as bad as I've seen it in Baghdad in particular, and that if not stopped, it is possible that Iraq could move towards civil war.
But Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld says it's possible to stop the violence and placed the success of unifying the country in Iraqi hands.
Ultimately, the sectarian violence is going to be dealt with by Iraqis, and it's going to be dealt with by Iraqi security forces as a part of the solution, but it's going to be dealt with through a reconciliation process, a political process.
Abizaid and Rumsfeld were joined by Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace. They said in the immediate future, the way to stop the violence is to send more troops to Baghdad. 3,500 U.S. military personnel are already being transferred to the capital, along with an additional 4,000 military police and other personnel. The general said they are fulfilling a promise made by President Bush to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki last week in an effort to secure Baghdad. It's a strategy that worries Republican Senator John McCain from Arizona. He questions General Abizaid.
Where are these troops coming from?
The Striker Brigade is coming down from Mosul.
From Mosul. Is the situation under control in Ramadi?
The situation in Ramadi is better than it was 2 months ago.
Is the situation under control in Ramadi?
I think the situation in Ramadi is workable.
And the troops from Ramadi came from Fallujah. Isn't that correct?
I can't say, Senator. I know they.
Well, that's my information. What I worry about is we're playing a game of whack-a-mole here. We move troops. It flares up. We move troops there. Everybody knows we've got big problems in Ramadi. And I said, where are you going to get the troops? Well, we're going to have to move them from Fallujah. Now we're going to have to move troops into Baghdad from someplace else. It's very disturbing.
The U.S. currently has about 133,000 troops on the ground with no intention of reducing that number soon. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina wondered if the U.S. is really wanted.
Is the Iraqi public turned against us or are they still with us?
I think they would like us to leave, but not before it's time. Okay. I think that they are still with us, but they would like, as we would like, to have foreign troops off their soil.
In Iraq, a different version of events is being put forward by the government. Iraqi President Jalal Talabani said yesterday, Americans will start leaving Iraq before the end of the year, a plan that many in the United States are endorsing. While Defense Secretary Rumsfeld was inside the air-conditioned Capitol testifying, family members of U.S. military wrapped up a month-long peace vigil outside. Carlos Arredondo's son died in Najaf 2 years ago this month.
I've been traveling around the country with a casket in the back of my truck, a real casket with American flag and my son's boots and dog tags. And I'm honoring my son and honoring all the fallen heroes. My son was Lance Corporal Alexander Arredondo, U.S. Marine. He was 20 years old. He got killed in the old city of Najaf, Iraq, by a sniper from Iran.
The family members will leave Washington today to follow lawmakers back to their home districts to keep reminding them about the deaths resulting from the war. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Israel's army is pushing its offensive into northern and eastern Lebanon today as humanitarian aid to that country becomes increasingly difficult with a severe water and medicine shortage looming. As the violence continues, Lebanon's prime minister said that more than 900 Lebanese have been killed and more than 3,000 have been injured. One-third of these casualties are children under the age of 12. Additionally, more than 1 million Lebanese have been displaced. That's one quarter of the population. We're joined on the line by our Lebanon correspondent, Jackson Allers. Jackson, comparatively, in a place like the United States, where the population is roughly 300 million people, we would be talking about the displacement of about 75 million people. What is Beirut like right now? Is it totally abandoned?
Actually, quite the contrary. Beirut feels completely saturated with refugees. Government sources estimate there are some 400,000 refugees mostly from the south, but also from the southern neighborhood of Dahia. They're all in schools and shelters and parking lots around the Beirut area. Supplies are dwindling, medical supplies, relief supplies, and so, no, they are crowded around the schools. It's a very saturated feeling, actually, here in Beirut.
The Lebanese government says that there is now a 7-point plan with Hezbollah for a sustainable unilateral peace. What does that plan look like?
Well, in essence, the government with Hezbollah, actually, because Hezbollah, one must understand that Hezbollah is a part of the government. They were, over the last 6 years, they've been incorporated into the government. They are a legitimate party. They have two members in parliament. They have two ministers. This is a 7-point plan that the Lebanese government had come up with in order to draw up a sustainable peace after a ceasefire. The ceasefire is what's being called for unequivocally by the Lebanese government. They're saying now the elements, the more moderate elements of the Lebanese government, for example, Lebanese Prime Minister Fouad Senyora, who had been very measured in his speeches in the past 2 weeks, after the Qana massacre on Sunday, it's clear that all of the Lebanese officials are very much pushing as hard as they can in very hard terms for a unilateral ceasefire. Now, that's an unconditional unilateral ceasefire that they're looking for initially. This 7-point plan that they laid out for U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice when she visited last week, a plan, by the way, that she actually approved of, this is a plan essentially that would incorporate the major concern of Israel, which is the deployment of Lebanese forces, the Lebanese army in the southern border areas, as a means of showing good faith that indeed, according to UN Security Council Resolution 1559, that Hezbollah would pull back and be integrated into a southern defense strategy. That 7-point plan, which has been essentially rejected by Israel and the United States recently because of Israel's move to try to get an international contingent into that southern border area, they seem to be ignoring this 7-point plan, absolutely disarming it and saying essentially, no, it's going to be on our terms. At this stage, that really means that Israel is being given a green light to do whatever it wants militarily until its military advisors are satisfied with their operations.
Jackson, Israel's offensive continues in the south. Can you give us an idea of what you're hearing about that in Beirut?
Well, my sources in the south tell me today that the assault has been incredibly, incredibly heavy along a quarter of about 8 to 10 kilometers directly north of the Israeli border. The army has carved out what they're calling a security zone of some 20 villages. The UN force in southern Lebanon said that the Israeli troops, some 10,000 troops, are in the ground working in five separate areas. the bombing has taken additional civilian life. A family of seven was killed in a southern village today after Israeli missiles fired into a village there. Let me just add today, this evening here in Beirut, the Israelis dropped leaflets all over Beirut saying that they were going to bomb the city. Hezbollah leaders Syed Hassan Nasrallah, then in a televised speech this evening, said that if indeed they bomb Beirut, then that is the green light for Hezbollah to pull out yet other aspects of their arsenal and take it all the way to Tel Aviv. The salvo came back from Israel that indeed if they bomb Tel Aviv, then Lebanon would suffer even more than it has, which is hard to believe because as it stands right now, they estimate the damage, Lebanese sources estimate the damage at $2.5 billion and climbing. There are 1 million refugees. The infrastructure is completely destroyed in this country. The aid agencies cannot get aid anywhere because of that lack of infrastructure and because they're targeted. So the idea that the Israeli military could inflict more damage on Lebanon is quite an anathema right now.
Jackson Allers is our correspondent in Lebanon. He joined us today from Beirut. Talks aim to bring an international force to patrol southern Lebanon and stop the killing continued at the United Nations today. French ambassador to the UN, Jean-Marc de la Sabrière, said today that there is an informal agreement among Security Council members on the sequence of events that needs to take place to end the war in Lebanon.
The sequence is first to start with a cessation of hostilities. That will allow not only humanitarian situation to be improved, but also during this period, the main parameters of the sustainable ceasefire has to be agreed by the parties. And then will come, you know, the international force, and the international force will deploy in a buffer zone where only the Lebanese army and the international force will be allowed.
Since the Israeli bombing campaign began 3 weeks ago, the Bush administration has refused to support a ceasefire, saying that what they call the root causes of the conflict have to be solved first. But at the United Nations yesterday, U.S. Ambassador John Bolton moderated his rhetoric, saying there was almost complete agreement on a political deal, which would lead to agreement on the mandate of an international force and its composition. French Ambassador Jean-Marc de la Sablière told reporters negotiations are ongoing.
Any resolution, also to be efficient, has to take into account key elements for both parties. We will work very hard with our American, with John Bolton, and, you know, we have to progress.
Inside Israel, however, there's increasing talk about a military occupation of southern Lebanon led by the Israeli military. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported yesterday the Israeli military is planning to occupy a so-called security zone 5 miles deep into Lebanon. That would be similar to the so-called security zone that was put into effect after Israel last invaded Lebanon in 1982, a situation that remained the same until the military pulled out of Lebanon. Ze'ev Moaz is the former head of Tel Aviv University's Jaffe School for Strategic Studies.
This is deja vu all over again, in a way, and just putting the IDF again, making it the target of guerrilla attacks. And the Hezbollah has been firing rockets on Israeli population center. This is something that we have to realize. Only virtually every time, only in retaliation to Israeli firing on civilian targets inside Lebanon. And placing an occupation force inside Lebanon will just do the same thing that happened over the last 18 years.
Ze'ev Moaz is the former head of Tel Aviv University's Jaffe School for Strategic Studies. A television interview with Chile's foreign minister this week indicated that the Chilean government has been sounded off by European countries to possibly take part in a military stabilization force on the Lebanon-Israel border. Foreign Minister Alejandro Foxley says that Chile is studying the possibility of taking part in a UN stabilization force. FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Santiago.
Chilean President Michelle Bachelet was outraged following the revelations of Israel's killings of dozens of innocent civilians in Cana, a small village in southern Lebanon. She also expressed her frustration at the inability of the United Nations Security Council in bringing a ceasefire to the region. Unsurprisingly, Bachelet expressed her government's willingness to take part in a UN peacekeeping force that can bring peace and stabilization to Lebanon. So the foreign minister's comments were then part of a government effort to enlist support for Chile's participation. But despite the willingness to study the possibility of Chile joining a multinational force, government spokesperson Ricardo Lagos Weber cautioned that before any military commitment is made, the United Nations, Israel, and Lebanon must agree to a peacekeeping force.
Chile is always prepared to analyze case by case requests for a multinational force, as we have done in the past in different places. We have forces in Pakistan and Haiti. So when the time comes, we'll decide if it's convenient to do so. And if we have the go-ahead, we will make sure we have a legislative mandate.
Last night, in a heated special meeting of Congress to study the Lebanese and Israeli situation, the lower house of parliament agreed in principle to give the government the go-ahead to volunteer Chile to take part in a peacekeeping force. But analyst Armin Kojumjan says Chile, while has the capacity to send a battalion comprising of some 600 to 800 soldiers, cautions that Chileans may not have the stomach to accept the potential losses of life.
If a Chilean force was sent and is involved in fighting and there are casualties, I think it would be politically unacceptable in Chile. And in fact, a Chilean official, soon after expressing goodwill towards this plan, added that they will look at it very carefully because they would not like to put Chilean lives at risk. I think it's a bit unrealistic. If you send soldiers on any type of mission anywhere, it is obvious that there is going to be a risk. And in this particular case, the risk is higher.
Chile already has a large contingent of UN troops stationed in Haiti and smaller troops in Bosnia, Cyprus, and Pakistan, and earlier took part in the East Timor UN peacekeeping force by providing air coverage. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
From his cell in Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
It is impossible to look at the present chaos raging through the so-called Middle East and not wonder why it is as it is. As a student of that region, I've read deeply on the subject. What I've learned from many of those sources are less to be found in distant history and more to be found in fairly recent history. When we think of neocolonialism, we think almost automatically of Africa and perhaps Latin America. We tend to not think of Arab states as dependent, neocolonial states, where leaders are but figureheads for distant masters in Western capitals. Yet in truth, their vaunted independence is little more than a sham, for these states rely on the West, in some cases, for their very survival. This is shown by the long and cozy relationship between Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Washington. When the theocratic monarchy faced external opposition, it turned to the U.S., even when such a turn was hotly opposed by a majority of their populace. And there's the rub, popular will vis-a-vis the will of princes. Many such states are, by their very nature, profoundly conservative, and thus look at change as dangerous shocks to social order. To preserve that order, they often employ savage state violence against their own people. As Lebanese scholar Assad Abu Khalil has written in his book, The Battle for Saudi Arabia, torture is commonplace in Saudi Arabia. In 1990, hundreds of Yemenis had reportedly been ill-treated or tortured in makeshift detention centers in Saudi Arabia, and thousands had been arbitrarily arrested for no apparent reason other than their nationality. Torture can range from flogging, even of children, to lashes and bodily mutilation. Of course, with torture comes coerced confessions. When suspects refuse to confess to crimes, they are intimidated, harassed, and repeatedly tortured, and may be held without trial indefinitely until they confess. In sum, Saudi Arabia remains one of the worst violators of human rights worldwide, and yet continues to enjoy eternal friendship from the United States and friendly relations with many countries in Europe. It seems to be immune from the criticisms that other gross violators of human rights receive. This is true not only of the United States and other Western countries, but also of international organizations, including the UN and its Secretary General, he writes. As long as there is foreign intervention, there will never be regional peace. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Amnesty International says Darfur rebels who signed a peace deal with the Sudanese government killed and raped civilians to try to force them to support the unpopular pact. The African Union brokered deal was signed in May by only one of three rebel factions, the Mini-Arkua Minawi Group. FSRN's Emmanuel Akella reports that tens of thousands of Darfuris have protested against the deal and are demanding further concessions from the Sudanese government.
The Minawi rebel group is reported to have launched a wide-ranging offensive against their former rebel allies and supporters, leaving at least 80 people killed and about 8,000 fleeing their homes. The London-based human rights group Amnesty International says some 72 people were killed, 103 injured, and 39 women raped in targeted attacks against civilians in the Comar region, about 40 miles northwest Darfur's main town. Elizabeth Hodgkin is a Sudan researcher at the Human Rights Group.
The Darfur peace agreement was signed between the government of Sudan and just one faction of one of the armed groups, the Sudan Liberation Army of Mini-Manawi. Since then, different groups have been attacking each other to increase their territory. And it's in this context that the attack happened at villages around Koma, which is about 50 miles from Al-Fasher, the capital of Darfur. But what's exceptional about Koma is the number of those killed, which we still find difficult to accept. We were given the names of 71 people killed. Seven of them were women, 11 were school children.
The attackers were said to be members of the Mini-Minawi faction of the Sudan Liberation Army, SLA. They were reportedly supported by the Sudan Armed Forces and their Janjaweed militia allies. The United Nations and African Union have condemned the attacks and denounced the Sudanese government for being in violation of a May peace agreement. Abdou Katuntu, a member of the Darfur Committee at the African Union Parliament, says the attacks are regrettable.
What we have appealed all along is to have, first of all, a ceasefire and then a comprehensive agreement between the warring parties, that the government of Sudan and both the armed groups in Darfur, the Sudanese Liberation Movement and the Just and Equality Movement. So if there has been a resumption of hostilities, whether one group is now aligned with the other against any other group, let alone the civilian population, then that's very, very unfortunate.
Since signing the deal, Minawi's troops have repeatedly been accused of imprisoning and torturing Darfuris who oppose it. They are said to be using the agreement as a springboard to attack those outside the deal. Minawi denies the reports, but a UN helicopter in June airlifted elderly SLA official Sulaiman Adam out of Minawi's stronghold in Darfur, where he had been imprisoned for weeks. Sulaiman had opposed Minawi's leadership and the deal. In addition, Amnesty International maintains that the 7,000-strong African Union peacekeeping force had not protected civilians and had not investigated the violence. Amnesty's Elizabeth Hodgkin says the United Nations should install a larger, better armed peacekeeping force with a larger mandate.
One thing that is necessary is to have a peacekeeping force which has a strong mandate, which will act proactively and consider it as part of its mandate to protect civilians and also to investigate and report publicly on what happened.
Amnesty said civilians had reported the attacks to the AU force on July 5th, but the Sudanese Liberation Army had opposed the AU going to Korma. Tens of thousands have been killed and 2.5 million forced from their homes during more than 3 years of conflict in Darfur. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela, reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News from KPFK in LA. I'm Ara Bogado.